When we start to talk about creative financing, this is one chapter in the programs we put on over the last number of years that changes quite often. And the reason we're phasing out this more and more, even going back to the first days when we started teaching programs and putting out books and cassette programs years ago, the thing you have to realize, we have never been into creative financing. Our basic goal and the thing we've pushed is the fact to go after nice, simple things. Don't put together creative transactions. Go out after things that are straightforward. And the reason for that is most people in a transaction are not afraid of things they understand. As soon as you start to become creative, the basic thing happens is you scare the other parties to the transaction. The professionals have to become very defensive because they don't know really what they're looking at. They keep thinking there has to be a hook there. There has to be some Mickey Mouse. And what they end up doing is holding back their clients. So what we try to do is stay away from creative financing. If you've been a follower of our program ever since we started many years ago, you would find that the creative financing section has probably had as much or more change than any other section of the book. We've changed, modified, and taken things out. Because what we're trying to do as we improve the program is get it to the point where we really don't have anything that we can even be called marginally creative. What we're about to go through on this tape now in the different sections, and I don't really consider creative, because you're going to find each one of the techniques that we have here have been used for a number of years and work very well. The normal MO or method of operation that I follow is I will then keep the things we're about to go through in this section over the next year or two. As we then get more experience and they become more accepted as standard ways of doing it, we will move them into the normal financing section. My goal over all the years in teaching has been to get to the point where someday, as I'm phasing out of teaching and retire, whatever I decide to do or pass on to the great beyond, is to have nothing in the book that has to do with creative financing. Everything is by the book. Everything is by the number. As we go through this section, I also want you to realize, again, as I already said, it is not very creative. It's something we do every day. The thing you have to realize, it's a little out of the ordinary. The other thing you're going to find as you go through this section, don't be confused by the fact that we call it creative financing. You might call it miscellaneous financing. The techniques also we're about to take you through are techniques that we use quite often, and you're going to find can be very beneficial for pushing that transaction along. Keep in mind as we go through the transactions here, or the ideas here, that these work on buying a business, they work on selling a business, and for those of you that don't realize it yet, if you're in the process now of selling your business, if we can teach thousands of buyers every month or every couple of months how to buy a business and finance it 100%, you have to realize if you flip it around the other side and you're a seller, you're going to find that you can actually sell that business and pull out all the cash. Now, if you decide not to do that, you're going to find in this section there's two techniques that you can use as additional security. So that if you do decide to finance that business that you're selling and you find that the buyer maybe isn't strong enough, you're going to find that there is available now on the market financial statements that the buyer can rent, which means that between the buyer and their joint venture partner, which is worth X number, $100,000 or $1 million, you, the seller of the business, don't have to worry about taking the business back because you have that additional security. For those of you that want a little more security, you're going to find that over the last few years we've developed a program to use real estate. And using real estate as security, you're going to find that you could take the complete security on the sale of the business as the real estate. So as you leave, you get a down payment of X number of dollars. You then have the security on any financing you provide of the real estate down the street or something that you like. It could be land, it could be an apartment building or a shopping center. And with that, you don't have to worry about taking back the business because you have a lien against real estate down the street, which maybe you feel a lot better about, you feel more secure with than maybe the business you're selling. Now, the first area I want to get us involved in now is a thing called large accounts receivable and accounts payable, which is section one in this chapter. Now, when you start thinking about it, you're going to find many small businesses have a large investment in accounts receivable and accounts payable. Usually the sellers have been advised to keep their accounts payable and receivables. This usually requires the buyer to come up with more cash to make the transaction work. I'm going to take you through this now. I'm going to show you how it does require more cash. I'm also going to show you how we use these techniques to finance businesses, purchases, sales. We also use it to finance part of the working capital we have. Because one of the reasons that people go through our program and learn the basic types of financing, end up doing so well year after year, is the financing not only works when you're starting a business or selling it or buying it, it also works when you're expanding it, which means you have to understand the basic techniques of financing businesses, not only when you're going in or going out, but you also have to know it on a continuing basis. Because if you have to go to the normal sources of financing when you're in business to expand or take care of a problem, you're going to find the repayment period is usually very short. The interest rate's very high, and whatever goal you had to accomplish by expanding or solving a problem, a lot of times the financing you end up getting buries you even further or ends up wiping out the benefits that you were after. Now let's start thinking about this now. When you go and look at a business, first of all, let's think about what are accounts receivable. Well, when you're in business, what you'd like to do is receive all cash. The reason we have a thing called accounts receivable is a lot of people come along when you're in business and say, hey, I'd like you to finance. Again, it could be a supplier, vendor, whoever you're working with, but they want you to finance. They don't want to pay you cash. They want to pay you in 7 days, 14 days, 30, 60, 90, 180. They want to pay you back in a year. So you end up in a thing called accounts receivable. So every month you're in business, you receive part of it as cash, and if you're in the financing business, whether you realize it or not, when you have accounts receivable, you are. And so what happens is you end up with a lot of accounts receivable. You're in the financing business. And when every time you're in the financing business, it means that you're going to have losses. You sold $100,000 worth. $100,000 was credit. You may only collect 90% of it. We'll talk about that later. The next category, we talk about a thing called accounts payable. And accounts payable means when you're in business that although you have the pressure of somebody coming to you and asking you for credit, a lot of the pressure of the people asking for credit is taken away in business. And how does that happen? It doesn't happen with bank loans. It happens because other people that are in business that you do business with allow you to pay in 7 days, 14 days, 30 days, 60 days. The ideal situation from a standpoint of win-win is to have the payables balance out the receivables. That way, you're not in the financing business, and neither is the other party. The thing you have to keep in mind in this example right here is we have a business that happens to have accounts receivable of $200,000. They have accounts payable of $200,000, so they sort of balance each other out. They do. Now you say, well, gosh, suppose that I don't take them over. I'll just take over the other assets or buy the stock of the corporation or whatever. Well, that's fine. But let's analyze this and see what happens if you decide or the seller decides not to sell these to you. First of all, when you take over, the thing you have to realize in selling this business, if you happen to be the seller or you're working with a seller, is the seller normally has to pay off the accounts receivable. Excuse me, the accounts payable. And although every one of you say, well, gosh, the business owes $200,000, the owner will have to pay off the $200,000 before I take over the business as the buyer. Well, the thing you have to realize is these things have to be paid off. Well, how do you pay off the $200,000? Oh, simple. We go out and we collect the $200,000 owed to the business. We then pay back the $200,000 that we owe. It doesn't work that way. The people that you owe money to, when they find out you're selling, want to be paid right now. The people that owe you money don't want to pay you for 14 years or never. And they're going to slow down. So what happens is the average seller, when they decide to keep these, usually find that they collect the receivables. They then have to go to their own bank account to make the pay off the payables. They find that irritating. And when they do that, most of the sellers that I run into will not go ahead with the transaction. And what they end up doing is say, I don't want to sell. They don't tell you the reason. They give you some other reason. I'm not going to do it. No reason. And what happens is you end up not being able to go ahead with the transaction. You don't know what happened to you. The key thing was they couldn't pay off the accounts payable because they couldn't collect the receivables. What is a general Hamel rule and a good rule of business? No matter whose rule it is, over 90% of the time you're going to find that collecting the receivables or taking over the receivables and payables works. It is one of the greatest types of financing. And in this cassette book, we take it from many different sides. But the thing you have to realize, it's one of your largest types of financing, whether you're starting a business or you're buying a large one. Or you're selling, it works very well. Or you want to expand, it's a fantastic way to finance companies. Now let's look at it from another side. Supposing you take over this business and there are no receivables, no payables. Why? Because what happened is the other owner kept them, the former owner kept them. Well, the thing you have to realize is accounts receivable means that you have provided a certain amount of credit. What you don't realize is in the first month or two that you take over that business, the receivables are going to climb from zero when you start to $200,000. That means $200,000 that you expected in cash is now going to be what? Money owed to you, which means it's a loan. If you had taken over this company and you had assumed the accounts receivable would run about $200,000 the day you took over. They would fluctuate during the month. But what would happen is people that owed you from the month before would pay you. You would then grant new credit. And at the end of the month, it would still be running $200,000. But what would have happened? Part of the money would come in, part of it would go out. But you'd still be staying at the level of $200,000. When you take over a company and you do not take over the receivables, the thing you have to realize is you are going to have extra working capital to cover the amount of accounts receivable that it's going to grow to in the next 30 to 60 days. Why? You need those receivables, or excuse me, the cash, to cover what? the credit you're going to give out. Because that $200,000 that becomes credit or accounts receivable to your company is money that you needed to pay bills. And if you don't have that money because you're in the credit business, what you have to do is have what? You have to have cash to cover that. So you end up with what? An extra requirement for more working capital. What is the easiest thing to do? Whenever possible, assume the receivables and payables. Let's discuss some of the reasons owners don't let you take them over. Number one, a lot of owners worry about the fact that you can take the receivables, collect on them, and rip them off on the business. Again, what you have to do is reassure them or put up guarantees in some areas so that they don't worry about that. The other thing is, a lot of times the receivables, a lot of them are not collectible. And because the receivables aren't collectible, the seller becomes very embarrassed by it, especially his best friends probably don't pay him on time. And what happens is, he protects his ego and also doesn't have to tell you about a problem he has by keeping them. And what you have to do is dig out what the problem is and tell him it's not going to bother you. And if there are things that are not collectible, you just don't want to take them over. Now, from the buyer's standpoint, you're probably sitting there now worried. Say, my gosh, if I take over those accounts receivable, how do I know I can collect them? Well, in this program, the complete cassette program that you're listening to and the book you'll be going through, by the time you finish, there's two things you're going to realize. Number one, in every transaction, what we do is we do a thing called aging. And later when you get to the chapter on balance sheet and you go through a thing called aging of accounts receivable, you're going to find that we actually will lay out all of the money owed to the company while we're buying it or running it, and find out who's past due, who isn't paying on time. And what we end up doing then is try to get the seller to keep those. Why do we want the seller to keep them? Because we don't want to take over receivables that we can't collect. Again, there's no fixed rule on it. If you go to the section on balance sheet, we cover that more in detail. So what you have to do is worry about that area, okay, as far as the accountability. Now, the other thing is, when you go to the other chapter in the book that has to do with making the offer to purchase, what you're going to find is in the offer to purchase and in negotiating, we also have the seller do what? We have the seller guarantee the accounts receivable that are not collectible. We don't normally do it in every case, but if you're really worried about them, what we normally do is build into the contract. And again, when you get the contract, you might decide to add that, a little paragraph that states that if the receivables are not collectible, you can then subtract the amount you didn't collect from the next payment to the seller. Does that always work? It works most of the time. Sometimes the seller does get irritated. But if you set it up properly and analyze them and only take over the ones you know are pretty good, you're not going to run into many problems. Let's get back to the example now. And let's start talking about this company. If we wanted to take over this company, what we're saying is we have two pieces of information, the accounts receivable, $200,000, the accounts payable, $200,000. Now, what we're saying is if these are not assumed by the buyer, the seller will have a difficult time collecting the receivables to pay off the payables, okay, which is one of the problems we talked about. So why don't we go to step two? As we look at step two, let's look at the total picture, because what we're saying here is we have receivables and payables, but what I didn't mention yet is what is the price of the business? Well, the owner wants $100,000. The owner wants $100,000. Now, is the owner going to finance? No. The owner wants all cash. Well, if you're putting off all cash, do you really think the seller cares if you have any background? Do you think the seller really cares if you've gone bankrupt? Because when you pay that seller the $100,000, the seller is going to be gone. And for those of you that are worrying about all these hang-ups you have and why you can't do it and your weak background, what you have to realize is when you put up all cash, nobody really cares. They don't care if you have a job. They don't care about anything. And if you'll think about it, you'll understand why. Now, as we look at this, we find the price is $100,000. If we then buy it for $100,000, we're going to pay the cash at the close of escrow at the closing. What we're looking at is, hey, why don't we take over the receivables and payables? And if you look at step two, you're going to find the price is $100,000. If we then take over the accounts receivable and accounts payable, first of all, you're going to find the accounts receivable happen to be what? A plus. That means they're an asset. It's something that is owed to the company. When you take it over, you have a plus factor there of $200,000. Now, offsetting this, the company also owes out $200,000 to whom? Suppliers, creditors, things like that, which means they owe $200,000. If you take over the receivables and payables, what do they basically do? They cancel each other out. The $200,000 of asset that you have is canceled out by the $200,000 that you're going to owe. So when you take them over, there's no increase in price. Why? It's $100,000 plus $200,000 minus the $200,000, which means the price still comes up to $100,000. Still, the bad news is, they still want all cash. But let's look at this now and see how tough it really is. Solution. Have the buyer assume the accounts receivable and the accounts payable. The buyer will assume only the good collectible receivables, and the seller will guarantee, again, we talked about that, the collectability of all of them. Now, step one, as far as financing it, we have a thing called accounts receivable. And on accounts receivable, does anybody have any idea of how much you can borrow on receivables? Well, if you look at the national, again, there are some receivables you can only borrow about 50%. But you're going to find on the average in the United States today, and we covered in another chapter, you're going to find on the average you can borrow about 80% of the value of the good accounts receivable. And if we assume that 200,000 receivables are very collectible and are very good receivables, there are factoring companies out there and banks that will actually lend you money against your accounts receivable, 80% of them. Well, if they will lend you 80% of the accounts receivable, what are we talking about? We're talking about 160,000. You're going to say, well, gosh, how can we do that? How can we get the money? Well, first of all, if you're borrowing money against receivables, all you have to do is have access to them, which you can get in writing the contract. You take them to these people just before you take over the business. They will then look at which ones they want to finance. And at the close, at that exact moment it closes, they will take the security of the receivables and pull them out of that little pot, the escrow closing pot, and replace it with $160,000. Okay? You putting up the $200,000 as security on the $160,000 loan. Now keep in mind, you can borrow on accounts receivable even when your company's going bankrupt. It could be a startup. IRS could be nailing the door shut. Why? Because the ability to borrow on receivables has nothing to do with the company that you own. It has to do with how collectible are they. And if they are very collectible, you're going to find it's very easy to borrow against them. Or later on in the program, you're going to find out you can sell them. Now, if you have $160,000 now, which will be available to you on or before you take over, how much money do you need to buy the company? You need $100,000. Big deal. You're always telling about how tough it is to finance. This gives you an opportunity to buy a business for a $100,000 price. You can finance the receivables, which is in most companies today, and you can usually borrow more than you need to buy the whole company if you wanted to go that way. Now, incidentally, that gives you $100,000. What do you do with the other $60,000? I like to say in our seminars that you send it to the Hamill Foundation. There's no such thing. Again, you can use it for additional working capital or for whatever else you need it for in the business. We, most of the times in our companies, we don't pull the money out, especially in the beginning, because you can never tell what's going to go wrong. That extra money always comes in handy. So what we talked about is financing the accounts receivable. Now, supposing in financing the accounts receivable, the people financing it will not do it before the close. Well, why don't you set a deal up? We're going to pay the seller $1 going in, and we then owe the seller $30,000 or $40,000 or $100,000. Why not pay it within 10 days or 15 days after you take over? You're going to say, well, you can't do that. I hate to tell you this. I work on hundreds of transactions every week, and I see it happening a number of times every week. All you have to do is ask. And if you're providing everything else and you just want a little time, a few days, I find very few sellers that I run into that really care. Okay, and what you're going to do then is you're going to use the receivables to finance the down payment or finance some other thing you're doing. Okay, it's not really a big step as long as you, the buyer, get over the fear of doing this. Now, let's take the next area. And again, we talked about financing receivables. That's an asset. So you finance assets. Now we're going to take you into the area of financing debt. You say, that can't be done. How can you finance something you owe? Well, as I take you through this, what you're going to say to yourself is, nothing can be better than financing receivables. Let me tell you something here and now. Payables give you even more money than receivables. Now, let me take you through this. And again, we're only taking it from one side. As you start to get out into the real world of business and just start to consider what we have in this section on receivables and payables, you're going to find that you can add things to it and change the technique a little and use these two areas to do all sorts of things in business, from startup to buying, selling, expanding. What you have to do is just open your mind a little. Not be creative. Just look at it, see what your problem is, and see how you can use these two items to solve your problem. And it does solve a lot of problems, you're going to find out. In fact, let me tell you something. This area of financing works so well that I see a lot of business owners get in trouble because the money comes very easy in this area. The paying it back or the interruption, the cash flow is the thing that ends up goofing you up. So the problem here isn't difficulty. The problem is what you end up causing problems in your company because it is so easy. Let's look at the accounts payable now. In our seminars, what we always do at this time is always ask the group, how many people here have worked for large companies or small companies? They raise their hand. I then say, okay, in the companies you've worked for, have you ever worked for a company or been with a company or owned a company that paid or had people pay them other than cash, maybe paying 7 days, 20, 30? A lot of people say, yeah, 30. They raise their hands. Then I said, well, have you ever worked for a company or been involved in a company where they pay in 60? I'll still get a large number of hands. 90, I get to have a large number of hands. So there's a lot of companies out there that are normally paying with approval in 90 days. You're also going to find a number of them paying 120 days, 180 days. When I'm in certain parts of the United States, three-quarters of the hands are still up at 6 months. If you get involved in a sporting goods business where you're dealing with the government, you're going to need 9 months credit because the government doesn't pay much faster than that. In the toy business, it's usually a payment of once a year. Okay, your bill the 1st of December, you pay the 1st of January, something like that. So you're going to find, although everybody in this country has a feeling that there's only two systems involved. In fact, if you don't believe this, go out and talk to business owners later. Half the business owners will tell you, it's not exactly half, hey, I always pay all cash. And the reason I pay all cash is if I get 30-day credit, it destroys my credit. So I always pay all cash. The other group of business owners are going to tell you, hey, I pay in 30 days. Anybody that pays cash is stupid. What you're going to find is both groups of people are really stupid because what you should be doing is working other people's money. And when you start to have this feeling that you have to pay all cash, and I understand that, what you're finding is you have to put more money in the business because you are not using the standard facilities available and avenues open in business to get financing. And you're going to find this financing doesn't cost you any money. And since there is no interest, in a lot of cases there is no repayment as long as you do business with them, we all think you're crazy not to do that. Now keep in mind, as I take you through different techniques like this, we call it the going to the well principle. There's a thing in business, which we discussed in another chapter in these tapes, that's called interbusiness financing. One business lending money to another. It could be receivables, payables, actual cash, which I'll talk about in another chapter. But the key thing you have to keep in mind when you start to go out in this area, the number one financing that we run into all over this planet, planet Earth, is interbusiness financing. Again, you can say banks, the SBA, they're very nice people, but they don't provide much money to the, for us in business. It's a very small, small percentage. So what we do is we go to these other sources. These other sources is the way most of us that are very successful in business do it every day, and we have been doing it for years. Now, let's look at the accounts payable now. If you look at the next page here, what I've done is laid out the accounts payable. It's laid out for a six-month period, and what it says basically, people are supplying with goods. In month one here it said, $200,000 in goods are delivered to you. Again, they're going to be called accounts payable. They're delivered to you during the month. You are billed. You pay 30 days later. In month two, you're going to find that $200,000 worth of goods are delivered to you. You order them. They're delivered to you. You are billed in a certain period of time, 15, 30 days. You then pay in a certain period of time. Normally, all of these are 30-day pay periods. And we run into a lot of companies that normally pay in 30 days. Now, suppose you wanted to pick up some money. Let me show you what we normally do. You're going to find out later in the program, we actually go out to these people to try to borrow money. We'll talk about that in another section. But right now, let's just talk about this. Supposing when you take over a company, they are normally paying in 30 days. Just think about this mathematically, not complex math. And look at it. At the end of the 30-day period, we owe $200,000. Since we've sold those goods, maybe for $300,000 or $400,000, we take $200,000 of what we took in selling those goods, and we pay the people at $200,000. Now, supposing, instead of paying on the average in 30 days, and again, when I say the average of 30 days, I mean some people are going to require you to pay all cash. Other people you'll be paying in 7 days, 14 days, 30. What does the average mean? It means you also have a couple at 60 and 90 days. And if you take the average of everybody you pay, it comes up to what? About 30. What you have to realize is, and what you're going to find out later in the program, is how do you move these out a few days? How do you move the 30-day average pay out to 40 days or 50 or 60? And also, what are the results if you move this out? Once you understand this concept, you're going to find it solves a lot of the problems in business as far as financing. And if you don't start to follow it, remember, whoever's at the end of the line that doesn't follow these techniques in interbusiness financing goes to the well. What does that mean? It means eight of us do this with other companies. The other person at the end of the line that doesn't know these techniques or won't try them has to do what to get the money? Because somebody has to pump money into the system. They end up going to a bank. So eight of us are getting benefit and not paying interest on money. The one at the end of the line decides, because they don't know what they're doing, they go to the bank or go to a lending institution. And when they do this, again, they usually don't survive. Why? Because what's happening is we're milking out their profit. And what you have to do is, number one, learn these systems. Number two, use them immediately. And when you're talking about receivables and payables, at least get to the point where they balance each other out. The reason they balance themselves out in a lot of companies across the United States is survival. It just ends up happening because the owner of the business realizes as they give out more credit, they don't have the money to pay. And so the accounts payable, the money owed, happens to rise at the same time they're giving out financing. It's just the only way it'll go. They don't have the other money. Now, as you think about this, supposing and we're going to do this later, we could show you how to move this up to 60 days. Instead of paying at the average at the end of 30 days, you can pay at the average in 60. Well, if you can do that, I want to ask you a question. How much do you have to pay on the average after 30? Now remember, we're not just getting a one-shot deal. We're not just going to pay at the end of 60 one shot, and then we're going to go back to 30. This is going to be an ongoing basis. Suppose we can pay at the end of 60. How much supplier money do we pick up? You're going to find in month one, if you're always paying at the end of 60 days when you first take over, it doesn't happen all the time, it just happens one time. How much of supplier money will you pick up? $200,000. Suppose that on the other hand, you're able to take the accounts payable and move them out to 90 days. Now, if you're moving them out to 90 days, how much supplier goods have you received and how much do you owe? You owe $400,000 for the first 2 months. But since you're paying 90 days late, have you not already taken most of those goods and already sold them? Yes. Don't you have the supplier money sitting there that you should pay them? Yes. And if you're paying in 90 days, if you just look at your sheet, those first two numbers there, the $200,000 and $200,000, are sitting in your bank account. Does that mean you don't owe it to anybody? No, you do. If you look at your balance sheet, you're going to find that the balance sheet, if you haven't paid, you pay at the end of 90 days, you're going to find there's going to be $400,000 extra cash sitting there. You're going to say, well, don't I have to pay it someday? Well, let's look at it this way. It's going to be offset on the balance sheet by having additional accounts payable. You also then can take this $400,000, whatever the amount happens to be, and do what? Use it for working capital. Does this working capital cost you interest? No, it doesn't. Because this happens to be an accounts payable account. And as long as you're paying on time, what do people do? People do not charge you interest on it. It's only when you pay late. And for those of you worrying, well, gosh, if we go out to 60 or 90 days, aren't we going to have to pay interest? Aren't we going to lose credit? No, you're not. If you are entitled, these are large companies now, if you are entitled to a discount by paying on time at 30 days, once the payment period moves out to 90, if you pay on time, do you realize you're entitled to the same discount? You better watch that because sometimes you're going to be on the other side. Now, suppose an example, let's go out a little further. Suppose we can move you out 4 months. And if you want to talk to your friends in business the next couple of days, talk to them. And you're going to find a lot of them are beyond 30 days today. I'm not talking about they're doing it arbitrarily because they can't pay the bill. They got permission to pay in 60, 90, 120 days. At 120 days, the amount is $600,000. But let's really be gross right now. Let's move all the way out to 6 months. You can move it out to 6 months. We have a large percentage of people that do that. I don't mean 50%, probably 10 to 20% that move it out to 6 months eventually. It takes a while. But once you do that and you're paying always in 6 months, you're going to have 5 months of supplier's money sitting there. Five times the $200,000, it comes to what? $1 million. You realize you have $1 million sitting in a company now. You want to do something really gross. We did this on a company in this example, which is a standard that we run into all the time, that only has a price of what? $100,000. It probably only makes $20,000 to $25,000 a year. It's not even a mom and pop. It's a crummy business. But on this business that you're looking at, in this example, which is very small, that makes $20,000 or $25,000, you could set it up, extend your payables, and end up with $1 million of supplier money in your bank account. You still owe it. But couldn't you put that in certificates of deposit and other money market accounts and receive a return if it's 10% right now? I mean, 10% of $1 million is $100,000 a year. I mean, you realize on this one technique, you can make $100,000 a year, $90,000 a year on a business. The rest of it only makes $25,000 a year. For those of you little faith that like to read Forbes magazine, the Wall Street Journal, I don't know exactly how often they run articles on things like this, but I'm sure if you've read those magazines or periodicals, you're going to find that if you go every week or two and read all the articles, within a week or two, there's at least one article in there that has to do with this. You just never understood it. It is a program and it is a method used continually all over the world by a lot of different companies. And if you don't understand the technique and you don't go out and use it, I hate to tell you this, you're cutting down the profit margin and the cash flow tremendously, which makes it easier or makes it more difficult to run your company, which means the thing really doesn't make sense. And what you should consider doing as we take you through these things is go out and try them. If you now sit there as you're listening to this tape and get a feeling that this doesn't work and you are not going to try it, you'll be absolutely right. If you then go out and try it, keep in mind one thing. There is nothing that we teach that works every time. But within our financing area, this chapter and the other chapter where we cover financing, I don't care what you're doing, if it makes even medium sense, you're going to find there's more than enough financing techniques to put together your startup, your sale, your expansion, or the purchase of the business. So again, let me restate, you have to go out and try them. If you're at the point right now that you don't believe this, what I suggest you do is start the tape all over again and keep listening to it. The purpose of this tape is to motivate you, is to educate you, is to reassure you, And I hate to say this, if you listen to each tape enough times to brainwash you. How do I know that? The tapes were set up that way, the program was set up that way, and based on our follow-up, it does work that way. So if you don't believe it the first time through, keep listening to it. And by the third or fourth time, you may not be able to stand my voice, but you'll be able to go out and try it, and you'll actually believe it. And guess what? It'll work. The next section, which is section two, is really the introduction for the last two parts of this chapter. And we're going to be talking about the financial statement and the real estate joint venture. In other words, people putting up their financial statement as a guarantee, or real estate as a guarantee, or joint venturing with you. And before we get into the meat of each section, what I'd like to do is spell out the general rules for the real world. And if you really listen and watch and understand the next few pages, you're going to find that you're not going to have trouble in this area. What happens is those of you that have the most trouble in this area are the ones that don't listen. If you still don't get it, just listen to it a number of times. First of all, example one. You're starting a business. You only have an idea. You have no business plan. You're buying a business. You haven't found it yet. You haven't negotiated it. You don't have a contract. You really haven't done anything. Well, let me tell you what the rule of thumb is. And again, I don't like rules of thumb, but you should understand these so you can understand whether you're working with us or whether you're doing it on your own. What you have to realize is how the world really operates. And there is no free lunch. First of all, the rule of thumb. A financial statement or real estate joint venture partner will keep 90 to 100% of the project. But why? Because you haven't done anything. You end up buying a job. You have a chance to buy back maybe 10% with cash and effort. Or maybe you'll be given 10% of the project. This happens quite often in these projects with venture capitalists, because basically in here we're going to be talking about venture capitalists that don't end up wanting all these time 90 to 100% of the company. So again, if you're starting a business and you haven't really done anything, or if you're buying one and you haven't done anything, you're not bringing anything to the table. The thing you have to realize, if we were to put you together with somebody, or you do meet somebody that's in this area that has the real estate or the financial statement, I might as well flat out tell you, you're not going to be satisfied. But again, I want you to look in the mirror and say, if you had the statement or you had the real estate, why would you give up more than this? Because you're asking for a free lunch. You're asking for somebody to come out and do everything for you, to provide everything, and you want all the benefit. Why? Why would anybody ever do that? And will they? No. I'm sure if you went to your mommy and daddy, they wouldn't do it that way. So what you have to do is welcome yourself to the real world. The next thing I want to cover in this area, because there's only two basic approaches. Again, have you done anything or have you? Example two, next page. You're starting a business. You have a detailed business plan. Again, you've done something. You put together this business plan. You're expanding your business and you have a detailed plan on repaying the loans and the safety factor. You're buying a business, which is another approach. You've successfully negotiated the purchase. The offer's been accepted. You've done a lot of work on it. You're bringing something to the table. What's the rule of thumb? There's a fairness doctrine that everybody uses out there. We don't talk about it, but this is the way the thing really comes down. This is the way people negotiate. This is how the transaction turns out. The less the risk, the more you keep. The more you bring to the table, larger percentage. If you want to go out and put together a transaction, have somebody come in and give a very small percentage of it, and then have a chance later of buying them back out, you can do it. As long as you've done what? As long as you have done everything up to a point. You have to follow the system. Some of you go out, you can't make certain things work, and you start to whine. Let's just end up this thing by saying one thing. The question is, the bottom of the page, which would you rather have? And think about this. Would you rather own a business netting $50,000 and own every piece of it? Or would you rather own a business netting $1 million and own 80% with an option to buy back the other 20%? Because the people that put up the statements in real estate don't want to stay with you. They want you to buy them back in 3 to 5 years. When we get to the section later that has to do with limited partnerships, you're going to find you can set up a limited partnership so that they are silent. And by law, they can't say anything, which means that you own most of it, you don't have anybody interfering, and you have a chance to buy it back. It enables you not to start at the top, but you're going to start off a lot higher than you normally would. And it works out very well. We start to get in the area of financial statement rental. A lot of people think it's a Mickey Mouse thing, and you have to realize one thing. We just don't arbitrarily go into people and say, okay, we have somebody with $1 million statement, $5 million, and $10 million statement. Although you can allude to it, we tell them the fact that as soon as we have certain information, we then will put you or you sit down with somebody else that basically is going to put up their financial statement. You then sign an intent to joint venture or a joint venture agreement at that time. But before we get into this, let's talk about the basics of this thing. Go back in the program. Although we've been telling people that we've been doing this for the last 2.5, 3 years. We started 2.5, 3 years ago. Basically, the thing goes back a lot further. We've been doing it on a sort of a formal basis for the last 2.5, 3 years. Before that, probably for about 10 or 15 years, 20 years before that, we've used the two different approaches we're about to go through a number of times. I have a lot of people in business and friends of mine in the real estate business also that use this technique in various forms. In fact, I'm sure it goes back thousands of years. There's nothing magic to it. Any comment I have to make is I wish we had come up with this program about 20 or 30 years ago. It would have made it a heck of a lot easier for a lot of us. This program we're about to go through now in this section and the next section works so well that what you're going to find is it's giving us a second and third level type problem today. And the problem really is these two programs work so well that now we have a situation where people that are basically really not qualified are buying companies that are a little too large for them. And because of this situation, we're having to work with people around the country now on providing more consulting help and more management help, and in some areas just having a company go in to run the business for these people because they're not far enough along to really run something that large. And again, it's just a new situation. But the basic program does work, just like a lot of other programs. Sometimes it works a little too well. About 2.5 years ago, when we first started getting involved in this program, we realized one thing. Everybody wants to have $1 million net worth. Well, I want to reassure you, when you don't have $1 million net worth and you're reaching for it, that's great. Many of you listening in the next few years will have $1 million net worth if you don't have one already. The thing that's fascinating, right now you're probably fantasizing what it's like to have $1 million net worth. Well, if you go out and follow what we say, you'll have that $1 million net worth. But on the other side, you're going to find that by the time you get to the point where you have $1 million net worth, it's not going to be that rosy. Why? Your goals and your sights will be a lot higher. And at that time, you'll probably need a $5 to $10 million net worth, which means you always really need somebody, because as long as you're progressing and growing, you're going to find as you grow and become wealthier and have more substance, you're working on a project where it requires even a little more than you have. Although you are wealthy, you're substantial, you need a little more. And again, if you do much reading, you know that this happens to everybody. There's nobody out there that can just stand on their own. I mean, very few people on each project. So what they need to do is bring in other people as silent as possible because they don't want to have a lot of interference. So keep in mind, you're always going to need something like this. And also, don't be afraid to use it. Now, the warning on the other side is, as you go through this, these things cost money. They cost ownership. Maybe you don't want to give up ownership. That's fine. But the key thing to keep in mind is these things also cost money. Now, if you're doing it with mom and dad and things like that, maybe they're not going to charge you. But whether they're charging you a fee, a piece of the company, whatever, there's a cost in this area. So keep in mind, you don't have to use it all the time. In November of 1984, we finally announced this program on a national basis. We had played around with it for a couple of years. We had started working on financial statements about $200,000, $250,000 net and above. And also real estate with equities of $1 million and above. And at that time, although it seemed like a good place to start, it wasn't. Because what happened was, although we worked with a lot of nice people in these different areas for a couple of years, we found on the smaller ones they have a hard time making them work. Because we then would have a person with not that much in the way of assets or equity working with another person in a business. And what would happen is each one of them would want 90% of what we were doing. And what would happen is it really didn't make sense. We didn't have 180% available. So what happened, we started gravitating. And again, I don't want to kid you. We probably quit the program every hour for the first couple of years. I mean, I was never so discouraged. It looked so good. It looked so simple. Couldn't make it work. Finally, about July, August 1980, did I say 85? I meant 84. We decided to move up to about $1 million. We had been working on larger businesses and real estate, so I decided that we pegged $1 million. And son of a gun, as soon as we pegged it at $1 million on the guarantees and the financial statements, it started to work. The numbers started to make sense. We had more security. And as we go through this, you're going to find that this is a win-win situation. Everybody wins. Now, the difficult thing is in the last few months to a year, I've been out presenting this all over the country to different groups on television, radio, and in person, is it is so simple that everybody has a hard time comprehending it. And the reason for it is even the simple things in your life are a little complicated. And because of that, you have a tendency to take the things that are really simple and try to build something into them. I can still remember the first real estate group I talked to, top real estate marketers, exchangers, commercial, industrial people in the country, a few hundred of them. And when I talked to them, they sort of sat there and looked at me when it was over with glassy eyes. I waited for questions, and we never got down any questions on it. True story. 2 weeks later, I finally got a call from one of them and said, I finally figured out what you're saying. Now, as a person that's been educating people and thinks that most of the time he speaks fairly clearly, it was really frustrating. Why? Because I couldn't figure out, how can I put across something this simple? I'm going to attempt now also. But keep in mind, do not try to build problems in, because you're going to say, this sounds like a stupid question. There is no stupid question. There is no stupid thought. But keep in mind, this is the original KISS formula. Keep it simple, stupid. This is simple. Now, let's start talking about the area. It's not uncommon for business brokers, merger and acquisition firms, and sellers to want to see a buyer's financial statement. This is perhaps one of the stickiest problems many of our graduates face when they go out to buy a business. A person can have all the attributes and motivation it takes to run a successful business, or start one, but may lack an impressive financial statement. If you've been a working person for most of your adult life, working for someone else, it's doubtful that your financial statement or your net worth and borrowing ability would impress anybody, or very many people. You know that you intend to creatively finance the purchase of the business, but you often don't wish to disclose the information early in the transaction. The answer is to involve another person in your buying team, a person who has a strong financial statement, and later on a person that has a lot of real estate equity. It opens up a lot of doors, but the key thing is with a real estate financial statement opens up the door. It opens up a lot of doors, and the reason we start with $1 million is it doesn't cost much more to rent or bring in somebody with $1 million statement. They're easier to work with, and as soon as you say $1 million to somebody that's selling or whatever, it opens up the door. I mean, they really feel good. They want to know that between you, and again, look at yourself. You may have gone bankrupt 15 times this year. You may be a convicted felon. You have to realize between yourself and the other party, you look AAA. And incidentally, even if you get into the business and you don't have a good statement, keep in mind that when you get into that good business, what do you have? You have yourself with all the problems and background and crummy financial rating that you have. And what are you tied in with then as you get the business? You have a good business that is AAA. Whether you're going in with somebody with a statement or later on, you get in by yourself, the business is going to make you a AAA person, and it's going to basically drag you along with it. The other thing I want to keep telling you, every one of you love to come to me and say, gosh, I don't have any money. I can't get into business. And I keep saying to you, I have that place on my wall in San Jose in the office reserved for the picture of the first business owner that used money going into business. I don't know anybody. I'm sure there are people out there, but I don't know anybody that started with money. That's why we go into business. I mean, if I wanted to buy something and had a lot of money, I'd go out and buy real estate, tax shelter, things like that. In business, we do it for one reason, cash flow. And you're going to find, as we talk many times, if the business has enough money to make the payments safely and have money left over, financing at 100% is not difficult. It's not magic. And as you know, if you've gone through much of this, you have a lot of money left over. There's nothing magic to it. What does a financial statement do? It opens up the door.
This concludes Side 1. To continue, please turn the cassette over.